You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. And if you're listening to this episode while doing your Black Friday shopping, then I want to let you know I'm a women's shoe size 7 and I could use some new Land's End slippers.
Love it.
But Amanda, I nearly called an emergency podcast after the Miss Universe pageant last week. Miss Mexico won the 2025 crown, but Miss Norway won the hearts of all the seafoodies out there when she walked out on stage in Bangkok, Thailand, during the costume portion of the event, dressed as a salmon.
I will admit that I did not watch the pageant, but I stumbled across Miss Norway and her salmon costume in my evening doom scroll. And all I can say is, like, what an icon. She owned it.
She did. So when she walked out, it was announced that the salmon-inspired gown mirrors both the delegate's movements as a baton twirler and the essence of Norway's leading export.
Can we get a perfume going? The essence of Norway's leading export.
Oh, that would be Norwegian a lovely salmon. Christmas gift. All right, I'm going to go check to that. But we'll include a link to watch the moment play out because it deserves to be seen and appreciated by all.
It was so memorable. Like one of those moments that could potentially live rent-free in my mind. And I'm sure it sparked quite a few searches about Norwegian salmon too, which is good because you always want to have the conversation flowing about seafood.
And always.
And if anyone finds any good costume dupes online, please send us the link because that's the only way I want to show up to the Boston Seafood Show this year.
Exactly. So I second that. But in real salmon news, the big headline for the market this week was that a tight supply outlook for 2026 means that prices are expected to rise to their highest average level on record.
Joining us now to share more insight is Dan Gibson, Undercurrent's EMEA deputy editor, who was in Norway last week reporting from the 2025 Arctic Securities Seafood Investor Conference, an event that brought together numerous Norwegian salmon farming giants, as well as the wider European seafood business community to discuss demand and global investments. But Dan, before you share with us what some of these analysts have to say, I would love to hear your thoughts on the viral salmon costume at the Miss Universe pageant.
So I thought that was just the latest sensational bid, clearly, by the Norwegian marketing committee to get salmon out there.
Although, do you think they had a hand in it?
They've absolutely, like, you would be surprised. These people have fingers in every pie. They regularly tell us how many countries they're involved in. And it wouldn't surprise me if they're involved in the Miss Universe pageant as well.
But I didn't think about that. It has everybody talking about it.
Yeah, I thought they had to go bigger, to be honest. I'm like, if you're going to, you know, be a full salmon costume, then the inside, it should have just opened out into the most amazing, like, salmon dress. And I felt it was a little sparse. It was like they needed to lean into it even more. You know, they needed to go 120% instead of just 110%.
Opens it up and, like, but there's, like, samples, but they all, like, shoot out at people. So that way, like, everybody in the audience can just, like, have some Norwegian salmon, right? Like, that would be cool.
It'll probably also make the dress considerably more expensive. You know, like, they just, it's hard enough to get salmon just going to these events, let alone from a Miss Universe pageant.
Yeah, seriously. So you weren't at the Miss Universe pageant, but you were at the Arctic Securities Seafood Investor Conference.
So I sometimes joke that basically my year is largely divided into shrimp season, whitefish season, and salmon season. And we're into the start of the salmon news beat now, where pretty much you've got companies are releasing their Q3s, they've put out their guidance for next year. And all of these banks as well, they're also now putting out their predictions. And the overarching message next year is that we are entering sort of the next stage of the salmon price cycle, which, for those who aren't aware, basically every 4 or 5 years, you sort of go through this process whereby they pump out loads of salmon, the price tanks, then they consolidate supply, they tighten it up, and they try to get, you know, the higher price that they're looking for to make it work. And next year, the expectation is, because this year has seen so much extra volume, like double-digit volume growth coming from Norway and Chile, next year they expect it to basically be stagnant. So what all these farms are targeting now is basically this year's volume at last year's prices. And what they expect, and what the first of these forecasts was from this bank, Arctic Securities, said they expect the price to go up about 22%. Because when you look at other proteins, when you look at beef and poultry, especially beef, the cost of burgers has apparently gone through the roof. Although, I mean, I can't say that's one of my beats, but if they say it, I'll take their word for it. And they expect that, okay, salmon has sort of bucked not just the protein trend, but also seafood in general, and come down in price this year. So they're thinking, right, well, there's this massive upside potential on spot prices if they can keep that demand high. And I think the big question marks are going to be over Chile and China next year. And I think that was the general message, because whereas Norway is trying to more or less consolidate its supply next year, Chile, I mean, they're just going to keep on growing because they've got this great tariff advantage now with access to the US market. And their biology is really good. And you can see already that the sort of the biomass at sea is growing year on year. And in comparison, I mean, in Norway, it was down 6% compared to last year, which it may not sound much, but like it's incredibly unusual to see that, right? Every year you see growth because, you know, these farmers, they're trying to eke out every tiny inch of capacity they can get their hands on because it did not come cheap. So to see it down 6% is their way of saying, okay, we've produced all this extra salmon and we're barely making a profit here. So they know that next year it will be tight for Norway, but they don't know what Chile is going to do, and that could potentially, you know, keep price soft if Chile start pumping out more volumes. And the other question, of course, ever since the tariffs have come in, Norway has had to pivot more raw material, I think, away from the US and into Asia. And so far, that's been really successful for them because China is just seemingly buying everything that they can offer them at. But of course, the million-dollar question here, or in this case, probably billion-dollar question at this point, is how much of that extra demand is tied to the low spot price, right? Because obviously China, the middle class is growing, but how fast is it growing? And like how much can they realistically afford to pay for salmon? And the message, I mean, you'd expect it. Obviously, it's going to be bullish. You've got a room full of salmon farmers, and they're expecting, or they think at least, that even if the spot price does come up, China being the size that it is, and the extra availability of salmon there, because, you know, Costco, Sam's Club, these retailers, they're moving into China. And that means that it's now so much more accessible across the whole country. So they believe prices will go up and that China will be willing to pay that. They will be willing to accept that. And they're also seeing these sort of filleting and smokehouse factories popping up now in China. And what that will do as well is it will open up the market to 4 to 6 kilo fish, which is basically the bulk of the Norwegian production. Because up till now, they've been pretty much dependent only on the larger fish, the 6 kilo plus, which the Chinese conventionally then use for sushi. And that's, you know, they tried to grow it to that size, but obviously not all fish does make it. So what they hope is that if this catches on, if you get more factory production coming in, then that will open up so much more of their production to sell to China. And that in turn should really help boost demand.
Thanks, Dan. Link to that story and further coverage from the Arctic Securities Seafood Investor Conference in the show notes. We've got one more friend joining us on the pod this week. On the line to talk about one of Lauren and I's favorite seafood soap operas is Undercurrents' Louis Harkel, who broke the news this week on the identity of the mystery investor behind a significant capital injection into Grupo Lamar, Venezuela's largest shrimp producer. Now, Louis, before you unmask the mystery investor, can you share a brief recap of Lamar's recent drama?
Absolutely. Thanks, Amanda. So yes, Grupo Lamar, a very interesting company. It was a rising star of South America's shrimp industry. So vertically integrated, think hatcheries, feed mill, farm, grow out ponds, you know, 13,000 hectares big. It was doing cooked shrimp, freezing it, and exporting about $200 million worth to Europe each year. So very large. Doing well. And this is a family-owned company. So in a country that's quite isolated and under heavy sanctions from the US, and Venezuela's economy has been in bad shape, millions have immigrated, US dollars are difficult to get hold of. You can't imagine difficulty and challenge of setting up a business like this in those conditions. But then in November last year, the Venezuelan government seizes the company and the founding Rincon family are accused of plotting against President Nicolas Maduro and have to flee. And at this point, it seems like game over, end of story, another company swallowed up by the Maduro regime. So that's where we were until basically I went to the China Fisheries and Seafood Expo in China. And that's where I met a man named Frank Somoja. And he works at the new government-owned entity. And
The
he's
story,
talking
you
very.
started off very slow here. The story could have gone, and that's where I met a guy named Frank, and he took me around a back alley, and And that's where I found. So yeah, so now continue.
Okay, yeah. Well, so I mean, I thought you might be like, oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, and then what happened? But yeah,
you just made it start sounding. You started it off sounding very sketchy, and then I met a guy named Frank. So you met Frank. All right, he takes you around this back alley, and then what?
Well, he tells me very bullishly about the company and saying it's got a new Turkish investor, and I'm like, okay. This is interesting. Can you tell me the name of the Turkish investor? And he refuses. And he says it's confidential. He can't tell me. And that's it. So, you know, we initially report the story like this. Brupo Lamar receives Turkish investment because, you know, one of the things in journalism is knowing when a story is good enough on its own to run. And you never know who might be reading. Perhaps a reader would get in touch with more information. So we publish that story, not yet knowing who the Turkish investor is. But the first thing I do when getting back to the UK after the China trip is message my colleague Matty, Matilda Merengeti, if she could ask her contacts in Turkey. Because Matty knows a lot of Turkish sea bass and sea bream industry people because she covers the market regularly. And one of them says, actually, yes, I do know the Turkish investor. It's the Milden family, and they own Miller Group. And
this is one of the best things about Undercurrent is that we have this global team that is hitting up all these different conferences around the globe, talking to Frank in these sketchy alleys about these things, and then going back to our team of reporters back at the office because we have people all over who have these contacts. This is awesome. So now we got this name.
Yeah, exactly. Now we've got this name, Miller Group. And it turns out this is a big Turkish conglomerate with fingers in a lot of different pies, but most of those are in Africa, particularly the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I don't know if you've been reading about what's going on there, but the DRC is a bit of a mess. It's one of Africa's poorest countries and has been fighting on and off for as long as I can remember internal conflict. But Miller Group, they've managed to walk in with relatively little fuss, it seems, and win hundreds of millions of dollars worth of government contracts. And these are mainly for infrastructure and development in the country's capital, Kinshasa. Now, just to be clear, we're not saying there's anything wrong with that, but this is clearly a company that has experience in working in countries with complicated politics and histories.
And so this is like, okay, as complicated as it could probably get, right?
Yeah. And so it kind of checks out, but we have no real smoking gun. But we're like, this is interesting. We have a name of the company. Meanwhile, separately, we also find out that the Venezuelan Minister of Industry visited Grupo Lamar at around the same time of the investment. And this guy who visited, his name is Alex Saab, and he's pretty interesting because he's a US sanctioned member of President Maduro's inner circle. And it turns out that through beneficiaries, he owns lots of shell companies in Turkey. And at this point, we need to credit my other colleague, Tom Seaman, for discovering this. But we have this company, though we've not confirmed it, and this visit by Saab. We think that is enough to run the story, but only cautiously linking Miller. We're not saying, look, this is cast iron. We're just cautiously noting the source confirmation, or at least suggestion they're involved. Now, at that point, you know, we've run two stories and we're still investigating. And it's kind of funny when you do stories like this that sometimes the final key piece is staring right in front of you. And it turns out that this was indeed the case, that in the marketing video on Miller's Group's own website, about 5 minutes in, which admittedly is probably longer than anyone would have ever watched the video, are pictures of Lamar's shrimp farm in Venezuela. So in their own marketing video, they have Lamar's shrimp farm. And even more compelling are the images of employees in Lamar branded t-shirts. So this to us confirmed everything. And so we ran a third story with a few more bits of new information confirming Miller's involvement. And so there it was. So yeah, from that initial exchange at the China Expo in Qingdao to confirming a new Turkish investor, we got there. And yeah, we gave ourselves a pat on the back, I suppose. But I suppose like it is also the kind of thing about, you know, well, why does this matter? Why is this so important? Why do we need to spend time investing into reporting like this? And I think the answer is because, L'Amour is more than just a story about shrimp. The initial story was about how they overcame the incredible challenges of building and running a vertically integrated company in a country like Venezuela. That was a success in itself. And, having spoken with the previous owners, I really got to understand how difficult it is doing that compared to, say, it's not saying it's not difficult elsewhere in places like Ecuador, but in Ecuador, we have everything set up, all the supplies you need, the feed, the cold chain logistics, even down to the packaging. They had difficulties getting the packaging for the shrimp. What they achieved was quite incredible. And doing $200 million worth approximately in exports, they had made an impact, definitely made an impact in the country, and were employing, over 10,000, I believe. But then it became, unfortunately for the founding family, a story about, with all that grit and hard work, as well as success, things can still go horribly wrong. And, I should note that they are still in exile. So, yeah, I mean, we always try to report in a kind of impartial and sober business style, steering away from the human impact side of stories. But this was kind of very much a human story as well. And it also means that by doing this, it is for the record. People can see when they go to purchase shrimp from this company, they know who they're dealing with. The information is there. And so if they continue to deal with the company, well, then, that's on them. But one to, for them to think about, perhaps.
Well, as always, link to the stories being talked about in the show notes found on undercurrentnews.com. Thanks, Louie.
Now, to hit a couple of other big headlines from the week, one U.S. seafood company is taking on U.S. President Donald Trump's tariffs in a new lawsuit. Natuno USA, based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, filed a complaint against Trump in the U.S. Court of International Trade earlier this month, charging the president with exceeding his authority when, beginning in April, he used the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, also known as IEEPA, to issue tariffs between 10 and 50%. The case is the first known example of a U.S. seafood company suing the federal government, demanding the tariffs be ruled illegal. Natuno, a major importer of seafood from Brazil, Ecuador, Panama, India, China, Indonesia, and other countries hit hard by the tariffs, is asking for a refund plus interest.
Natuno is being represented by V. Adam Law in Fort Lauderdale. The company's lawyer told Undercurrent that he predicts many more similar suits to follow. He said that the lawsuit places the company in a better position than others to receive a refund if and when the Supreme Court rules against the tariffs. Our editorial director, Cliff Voigt, has a big deep dive into the story, so link to check that out in the show notes. But staying on the topic of tariffs, the latest import numbers are out, and the data shows that U.S. seafood import volumes have dropped as Trump's tariff rates have jumped higher.
That's right. According to the latest data from NOAA, the U.S. imported just over 252,800 metric tons of seafood worth $2 billion in August, which is the same month that tariffs rocketed up on several important source nations. This is the lowest volume since February of 2025, when the U.S. imported around 252,500 tons worth $2 billion. Remember that India, one of the U.S.'s biggest seafood import sources, got hit in August with a combined 50% tariff. That was 25% on August 1st and another 25% on August 27th. And Indonesia agreed to a 19% tariff starting on August 1st. Both countries had 10% tariff rates prior to that.
Jason crunched the numbers and found that as much as $211.5 million in tariffs were paid in August on seafood, which was less than the $228.5 million spent in July. But that's because there was less to tariff. So U.S. importers were rushing to get ahead of the bigger tariffs in July and had brought in 311,000 tons of seafood worth $2.5 billion. In other major trade news, Beijing has renewed its suspension of Japanese seafood imports. Recall that Beijing imposed a 2-year blanket ban on Japanese seafood in August 2023 after the release of treated water from the Fukushima plant. The ban was only recently relaxed, with about 6 tons of frozen scallops from Hokkaido shipped to China on November 5th. But just a few weeks later, on November 19th, Tokyo was informed of the import freeze. The move is widely being interpreted as political retaliation for remarks made by Japan's prime minister.
Japan was once deeply reliant on China as a buyer, but multiple sources told Undercurrent that it appears as if Japan's seafood economy is moving into a post-China era. Sources said that the partial reopening never restored trust among Japanese exporters, and the refreeze has done little to unsettle an export structure now built on diversification rather than dependence. In fact, one Tokyo-based scallop distributor told Undercurrent that this isn't 2023 anymore. China shutting the door is no longer a crisis. It's a reminder of why the industry stopped relying on China in the first place.
And finally, we're wrapping up this episode on a lighter note with some celebrity seafood shout-outs. I always love a good celebrity endorsement. And Kathy Ireland became famous in the 80s and 90s as a supermodel, appearing on the cover of magazines like Vogue, Cosmo, and Sports Illustrated. Fun fact, I was an intern at Cosmopolitan in my youth.
Oh.
Yep. Okay. So, but Kathy Ireland, she's now a successful businesswoman. She added a new occupation to her resume. She's now a commercial fisherwoman. So, Kathy spoke to Fox News Digital this week about obtaining her commercial fishing license in California and working as a crew member on a vessel that's captained by her husband and a former emergency room physician, Dr. Greg Olson. She recently took to Instagram to post a photo of herself on the boat out fishing for spiny lobster. But what I really liked about this is that she took the time to speak about the importance of safety out at sea and the hands-on training that she went through. You know, like she posts this picture of her out on the boat and she's like a supermodel. So of course she looks like amazing out there wearing like all this
Of
lobster
course.
gear. But it's not a joke.
It's
She
not
went,
just for the Instagram.
yeah, she had, she's like, I went through all this hands-on training. She talked about the emergency procedures, how to locate and use the emergency beacon, alerting the Coast Guard and all this stuff.
That's awesome. I mean, it is a very dangerous occupation, so it's always nice to hear a public figure speaking about safety. You know, we can all take that for granted
Yeah.
sometimes. So, on to our next celebrity, Kylie Jenner, who gave shrimp some time in the spotlight this week after sharing a recipe online of her cooking shrimp tacos.
And whether you're a Kardashian fan or not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
It
You
doesn't
can't,
matter.
no, you can't deny that those girls, they have the power to sway public opinion. And those tacos looked good too. Did you see the video?
I did. I thought they looked great.
And the recipe looked really simple too. You chop up some veggies, you saute it, you add shrimp. She just used like peppers, onion, and like cilantro. I mean, it was like a free promotion for shrimp. It caught people's attention. And then there was like a bunch of videos too that came out after of like people saying like, oh, I tried Kylie's shrimp tacos and this is what I thought. And those videos have like a bunch of thousands of views
Right.
on them. And it's like, it's amazing. And
It
it's like, I'm
sets
like,
the wheels in
yes.
motion.
Go Kylie, go Kylie. And then there's so not only Kylie, but I don't know if you're familiar with BTS or K-pop boy band.
Of
Okay,
course.
I mean, of course, we've entered our K-pop eras. So Jungkook, probably saying his name wrong, but he's one of the guys from the band. He also took to social media this week to share a shrimp pasta dish that has all the girls making popcorn eyes at him. So if you don't know that reference, it's from K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yes, of course.
Of course, of course. But yeah, and so like that video blew up. So Lauren, if you could have any celebrity to make a seafood recipe video, who would it be?
Oh gosh.
I know, it's tough,
This is
right?
some it is tough. This is something I need to like think about.
Well, if you could have any celebrity endorse seafood and just cook it up on their social media, who would it be? Let Lauren and I know. Shoot us an email, shoot us a message, comment on our YouTube page. All right, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.
Bye-bye.